Okay.
Okay. Well, I went to New Jersey to Upper Montclair somewhere. I don't know. It's a beautiful place. And she hit me in her room and brought the food up so nobody should see it and kept me there. And finally she said, I can't keep you any longer because I don't know where to take the food from. And I didn't have any money either. So I went home and I didn't dare to go to that aunt in the hotel right away. Well, I ran away from. I went to an aunt in New Jersey, in Newark, New Jersey. Well, she was intermarried, not really an aunt, but I called her aunt, and she just could have been my grandmother or somebody. And I went in the house, rang the bell, and she came. The first thing she did, she slapped me right and left and called me names. And what a terrible thing I did to my aunt. And where do you come from? You're the biggest slob, and you know, in German, that rattled off like. And I said, well, I was with Clara, so-and-so, Clara Brown was her name. I hit there, what did you hide from? Then I told her why. And, well, she says, do you understand German? She said to me, you dumb goose, why didn't you tell that? Because I was afraid. Tanya Frieda wanted to marry me, and his aunt too, and I didn't want to get married. Well, then she could understand it better than she telephoned. See, they went to the police. The police looked for me because I was such a young girl. I never forget. Oh, I can't talk that in there. I was so young yet, not even 17. And that was my only out. I wasn't going to be trapped and married to that guy. And so this is how I did it. But then, when that all happened, then, if I wasn't going to do that, then I had to go back to Germany, which I did with my aunt. You see, my aunt, the people from the factory that my uncle helped or where he worked, started. Their men came and packed everything and got home with her children already because she got a pension from the factory in Germany. She went out there, so she went back there. She didn't know much English yet anyhow, and I had to go with her. Well, Amelia was my stepmother. You didn't want me either. And my grandmother was living with one of her daughters. There was really no place. And I didn't know what could I have done. So they thought it up between themselves to learn that I should go in the hospital and learn nursing. And I went in that same midwife school where my mother's sister had learned to be a midwife. They hire so many girls, they become infant nurses, and they have to do the work there and learn different things. She also trained to take care of the confinement cases, you see, which isn't here use in America anymore since people took doctors in hospitals, but those days. And I had to stay there a year until I got the diploma. Then this aunt that owned this hotel that was so immensely rich came out there for a visit. And by now she had forgiven me a little bit. She had bought diamonds. She had gotten the wedding all gone. It would have been in that hotel and everything. And she was at first mad at me. But then she was friendly again, and I talked to her, and I said, oh, I just want to go back so badly to America. Why don't I talk to my father so he'd let me go? See, then I was going on 18, I think, or something. I was a little older. And she did. She even paid the... I had to pay it back later, but she laid out the fare. Those days, second class was $55. I don't know how many hundred. And so I came back to America, and at first I stayed with her, and then looking for a job. And through her connection, I got that job with that French couple that went to Paris and took me along. You see, that was then my first job in America. And from there on, I was working in nursing. But it was such a way my destiny got changed by going to Paris that time. I liked France, you know, and that kind of free life. And I thought, if I learn French, then I can get a governess. And oh, my wish was to travel to see the whole world. And I thought I'd come back here someday and stay long enough to learn French. But for the time being, I was on contract for a year. That's what they used to do with newborn babies. They took a nurse that gets paid better, and they trained for young rich people to. And later on, they took just a nursing girl when the children were big. Well, I came back with them here and then went to my aunt again to stay. And how it went on, then, what was my second job? Oh, I was in America then in different jobs. I was with a family where I took a little boy and the baby wasn't even born. And I was with them in 1911 yet, and that was the hottest year I ever experienced. And it stands out in the records that that was the job. And so I had the baby then to take care of, and that little boy. And he, the little boy, we had him in the bathing suit down on the beach. We went to a city on Jersey Shores, a famous resort. I just can't say the word now. No, near there, but not Atlantic City. Belmar, where the rich people had homes, and they had a big home there. And I had a whole top floor for me and the kids. And in those days, they had lots of help, a cook, a waitress, a chauffeur and whatnot. You didn't have to do no housework or cooking or anything like that. So I was with them, and being in that salt water, I spent so long and so much with my wet bathing suit because the children I had attend to. On the end of the season, I got very sick, very sick. And no doctor, no matter, they got doctors. They sent me to and got in the house, and it started out by me not menstruating anymore. It's a funny thing. My blood was turning to pus or something. I was sick a whole year, and I have a rip gone from that. That's the only sickness I ever had in my life. Well, it turned funny. After a while, she said, well, you're really sick. You better go to your aunt. You need to be in bed and have care. And I did. And my aunt said then to me, I had been to several doctors. And so my aunt said, you go to this young German Dr. Kessler. My aunt knew the father, who was also a doctor. And I went over there to his, what do you call that, when his office was open. And he said to me, undress yourself. And I started my story out like this. I haven't menstruated for 3 months. And I feel so funny, it hurts me here. And it did, my head pounded all the time, and I have a headache, I called it. And he asked me several questions, and pretty soon he said, well, haven't you got no father for the baby? And I looked at him, father, I had never had a sweetheart even. Father, in those days, it was so Puritan here, that was terrible. And I put my clothes on real in a hurry and started to cry. And he patted me on the shoulder and he said, never mind, I helped you. I don't know to this day what that meant. But I couldn't get out of that office fast enough. I was so insulted. And I didn't even ask him how much I owed him. And the next day, from all this excitement, I had a high fever. And I couldn't go to the doctor. So my aunt called and got the same doctor back. And I said, I don't want him to ever come near me thinking I'm going to get a baby. My aunt said, you wouldn't be the first one. And put it off as a joke, but I was really, you know, that's really racist. And so he comes up, and I heard him talk from the door to my door with my aunt, and he says, that dumb goose, why didn't she say so? My aunt said, it's impossible. She's never been out with a man, and she never had a sweetheart. And he said, that dumb goose, why didn't she say that? Then, the high fever and all, they found a pleurisy. You know, and that had turned to water, and that turned to bust because it wasn't tended to, but I had the effects of that constant fever and headaches and all, and that bent my rib. Then, instead of staying there with that doctor, I got my girlfriend to go. She was going home anyhow. I got her to buy a ticket, and we both went back to Germany, and I couldn't make it from the ship. In Hamburg, they took me to the hospital. I was too sick. I had such high fever that they had to open this on the way on my trip to get the pus out. I had collected that much blood. And after the fever went down, and then they transported me with an ambulance to the hospital, Eppendorf or Krankenhaus, I'll never forget a surgery or barracks, what they call hospital each. And they put me in a hospital where they put people where they don't know what they have yet, the examination place. And in the morning, see, after that plus was gone, I could sleep. I hadn't slept for weeks, nights. And I could sleep, and I hardly got awake, and I was in the room, and here comes this doctor with his beard, the pointed beard, and three, four other doctors with him, you know, learning with him. They were young doctors. And he says, take, and they had put a shirt on me that closed in the back, and he says, take those, your shirt off. And I said, and two sisters were with them, you know, they had such a high respect that they have a talk on the doctors, the head doctors around. And I said, I will not when those men are gone. And they all laughed, and he said to the young doctors, go on out. And then he examined me, and he had to put, see, I was opened already here to get that. He put a sonde in there, in German it's a sonde, to see how far he could get down. And this beard of his kept tickling me all the time, and I had a laugh. And the nurse said, shh, Wilhelmine, shh, and help me. I said, well, tell him to keep his beard away in English. And they didn't understand it, but the doctor maybe did. He had a laugh. He didn't tickle me anymore after that. And then that's where the matter started. You see, he found out what it was, and I was 4 to 5 weeks in that hospital before I could be transported to the south. And they put me on a train, and I was laying all the way, and on the other end was my father and my people to pick me up, and I was sick. That was over, altogether over in a year, but maybe 7, 8 months I did not menstruate. And that person all was gone, all of a sudden, that came back. And, of course, after a while, nobody thought anything about it. They knew it wasn't a baby that I had. I was very sick for a year. But I got better after it was all over with. My father sent me to the Black Forest for 4 weeks. And then that is how I got that job for the peace organization, because I couldn't work a whole day. That was my first job after my illness, and I wasn't supposed to work full yet. And they were looking for a girl that knew English. And so I got the job because they got so many orders from England and from English-speaking countries like Australia. We had to send books all over the world almost if they had in the secretariat in the main place of the, I want to say the right word for that organization, Pazifistische Organisation, a society for pacifism. That's it, right? That's what I was working for. They were anti-war, and you know, that's something in Germany. And anti-military, and they were all sort of outcasts, but it was a pretty big organization then already. And there was a book that's written in all languages, and a Baroness, Bertha von Suttner, she wrote that book, oh, it must have been maybe 1890 or maybe even 1901 or some such time, and it's the name of it is Die Waffen nieder, in French it's Aber les Armes, in English it's Down with the Weapon. It's in every language, and it's such a crying book and such an argument against the war. And she was the wife of a high officer, and her sons were officers, and she lost so many. I don't know the detail anymore, but I read it a couple of times. And that book, as young as I was, got me so influenced against war and militarism. For the rest of my life, I couldn't call any war right or good. And when I came to America the second time, the first thing I did was that I got my application in for my citizenship. The second thing was that I trained Jane Addams' whole house organization all the years I paid into that because she was against war. And other things, too. I admired her. And what I want to say is how you can get influenced young with something that directs your whole life, sort of. You know, it wasn't popular in Germany to talk against the war because you were talking against the Kaiser and the whole royal family and all they stood for. All through my life, I thought, why can't we create a different kind of patriotism? You know, because everybody that's fighting and losing their life for their country are doing it with honor, no matter who they are, whether they're French or Africans, or they think they're doing the right thing. You can't be on both sides of a warring faction. Well, I shouldn't lose myself in these thoughts. But that's how my life went. Then I had another very funny idea. I got to, you know, when I came back from France and lived in Germany, every German woman seemed to have no other destination but getting married and being a mother. Nothing else, no matter how smart she was otherwise. That, and they used to, nobody could talk to me anymore when I got older and they considered me an old maid. They would say, well, what are you waiting for? You're not that pretty, you know, things like that, especially my stepmother. I don't know why she wanted me so madly that I was married or should get married. And I wanted to travel. I didn't have, and because she told me young all the time when I was home all those years, you'll never get a husband. You're so ugly. I had acne, you know. And she would tell me every day how ugly I was and how I would never get a man for my looks and so on. And I thought to myself, who needs them anyhow? And that's why I did a lot of reading awful young. I made myself independent from having just a value if I find a man. But finally I broke down. Germany had nothing to eat and America was closed. Their doors were closed for me, and finally married two. I married him because I felt sorry for him, hardly any of those boys who came back and them were healthy and whole. Most of them, I know so many in our family that the men got killed, either what they were engaged or they were married, and wars do that. And that was one reason I was so against them too, because it changes, can change it. The color of a whole nation. And then when I was told, or when I read in history, how the ruling houses all over Europe are related. I forget now, wasn't Queen Victoria the Kaiser's sister? Someone was close, or cousin, close relation. My father used to say they're inbred, they're also stupid because they're very among themselves. And well, anyhow, I don't know how it came in sequence. Well, I stayed in Germany because I got married then. You see, when America went into the war in 1917, before that, I could have come, but my father wouldn't let me. He said, and it looked like Germany was going to win the war. I know I learned French faster in the wartime when I was over there out of the newspapers every day at first. It's the Les Allemands sont avancés, you know, the Germans advanced. And I used to crunch. I had to face all these French people. I was the only German in that whole household before I was interned. And at one night, I know nobody ate in the whole castle because the Germans were so close to Paris, only that they had a couple of fools on as head officers. They didn't make it. They never took Paris in the First World War. Yeah. And but being there and living with them and they, you know, and facing them, not the parents, not the parents of my children that I took care of. They wanted me to stay because I guess I was conscientious enough. Those people who never home with their children, they have that somebody they can rely on. And I was there. I wanted to stay there long enough to get French, learn French. You see, the mother of my two girls, she had learned German, and she could speak it a little. But when she spoke German, I had to bite my tongue not to laugh at her because she got angry if I laughed at her, and she couldn't say one sentence partly straight, but neither could I. She could laugh at me out loud. I made some awful mistakes. One night I happened to be near the entrance hall and a couple came. It wasn't my job to open the door, but I was just passing. And they came in and they said, "Oui, monsieur, madame." And instead of saying, "They're in the," I said, "I'll sit down in boudoir, the baignoire," when I should have said boudoir. "They're in the bathtub," and they were in the small salon. You know, I made mistakes like that. And she said one time, "Don't ever talk French when I'm having tea." She nearly choked on something I said. We were in a farmhouse one time. There was a family by the name of Deville, the farmers. And they put me and the girls to this little town, Champacy, to stay in the fresh air while he had to be in the bank and she had to be about her social affairs. But they would come out every day, but they didn't sleep out with us. In a nice little apartment, and that Madame Deville couldn't speak a word of German or English, so I had to converse with her in French, and we had always food left over from, and they didn't want me to heat anything up, so I gave it to her for her animals. And I wanted to say, "You know French?" Mm-hmm. "Look, no." Well, instead of saying to her, "Voilà quelque chose pour votre bête," which is, "Here's something for your animals," I said, "Here's something for you, animal." And I repeated that, and they nearly died laughing. It must have sounded awful funny. But the lady, this Miss Madame Deville, she knew I was a mistake. She didn't get mad at it or insulted or anything. And I was allowed on my day off to go to a teacher for French lessons. And I found a girl, a young girl, Mademoiselle Fina was her name, and she wanted to learn German from me, and I learned French from her. She was a teacher. And we became good friends and kept writing to each other. And I was in Geneva. This was near Geneva. I was 1 year first with the family in Geneva. And so I was there, was it 72 or 71? I was in Europe often. And I wrote to her, and we met in Geneva, and we went to a cafe together. She was old and wrinkled up, and so was I. All these years we hadn't seen each other, but we loosely kept in contact, and she never married. You know, I have such nice and such worthwhile memories of going to these countries and going around so much in my life and make contact with people. For instance, when I was in Germany, and the only job I had in Germany with the Bamberger was their name, a very well-to-do Jewish family that had first-rate stores. And she was her first baby. And she couldn't ask me enough about America. You know, that was a special attraction. Because her uncle Baruch, she was a born Baruch, and you know, well, high up in our politics is a Baruch, that's her uncle. And while I was with them, he was their grandparent. We went to Neuwied, that's on the Rhine. They lived there, and her and I went there for a few weeks. And so while we were there, the princess of the King of Wittenberg was visiting there, and she entertained the GIs, the German GIs, and it was cherry time. So this affair was in the park, and he was high enough in society to know her, and he was so proud of this baby, and I had a great big an immense carriage that, I don't know what it cost, beautiful. And he in his silk hat and cane and striped pants went to this picnic affair that I thought, how crazy to go dressed like that, but what did I know? Well, I went with him and I took care of the baby, and he showed her, this princess, the baby, and I just nodded. I don't know what I did. Oh, when she was gone, he chewed me down. He said, I had absolutely no manners. I was supposed to have bowed down, almost kissed. I said, I never met a princess in my life in America. You don't do that. I blame everything in America. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, because he took his hat off and bowed way down. Well, I'm not a man. I never had lessons that way. I bumped up with royalty now and then through the jobs, you know, so that you would talk to them and see that there's nobody else but me. Act with the very same, go on the same tools and everything. Well, that was one interlude with the Baruchs, and he could talk with me about America by the hours, the grandpa, because his brother, two brothers were over here. Now, I was caught out there, and I couldn't come back while America's gates were closed, and I wasn't a citizen yet, had I been a citizen. But I couldn't get my citizenship here before I was 21 those days. And I left sooner than that, and that's why I had to stay so long and get reacquainted. I had a job when the war came in August. I had a job to Africa with an engineer that had an English wife and one baby. And they took me along for the baby, wanted me, and I had a job. And I had written home that I was going to Africa, and here comes this war and declaration, and with Germany, my father and my aunts and the people I had in Germany, they wondered where I was, and there was no contact at all at first. Later on, you could through the Red Cross, but they didn't know where I was. So when I got back to Germany, my father said, you stay here now till this war is over, being a young girl like I was. But then that went on until 23, beginning of 23, the first ship was allowed to dock here and leave Germans here. So, and ever since then, I was 26 years here before I ever went back to Germany. See, then the Second War had to be over to be able to travel again. And meanwhile, I had come back here and made a place for us and got the boy over, got my son over, and he never worked for anybody else but the Navy, but he took to radar and to that kind of work. He worked in the Missile Center until he retired a year ago. And so, but I took my grandchildren, each one over, one summer to Germany, and they took German up in school, but they didn't do too much except Margaret, the teacher, her second language. She got a hold of it pretty good, and she went back on her own to stay with relatives one whole summer. And my son's still my starting again to go to college in the evening to perfect his German in hopes that he can go to Europe. To camp, to go all through Europe, not the, that's such a nice name for the travelers, the way they travel, you know, not the way, I can't say the word right now, not the ordinary way that people travel. He wants to get to know it in depth, so he goes pitching camps and hiking and what have you. He's inclined that way anyhow. He's been up on all the big mountains. And so, to me, Germany fades out, you see, being here so long. That's when I did go over there last Christmas. 1977 Christmas I flew over. And while things were still the same, the Christmas market and the chimes and the public Christmas trees was just the same, and the same cobblestone flooring and all, and they ate the same sausages and drank the hot wine and sang the Christmas carols. But still, I'm too Americanized to take to that anymore. It's all right to have for a season, but it's so different here, and you're used to it. But I can, looking back and remembering how, of course, I was never so homesick. I dreaded to go back to Germany on account of my stepmother. But other people get at first pretty sick, although I don't know what for. Everything is here easier and better to come by, easier to come by. You have to be, I don't know, I don't want to say anything now because I've been away so long and everything has changed there too, including youth and their habits. So I can't say how they do everything except that they have seemed to have the same problem as we have with the foreign nations. See, they needed workers so bad, and they brought them all in from all countries, and to give them an incentive to stay there and work there, they gave them the same citizenship rights as the Germans, and none of them are leaving anymore, and so that creates, you know, conditions like the housing and stuff like that. It's in a bad way because there's too many people all of a sudden, not just their own, but all the ones that piled in. But in Germany, it's now like it is here, all that manual work is mostly done by foreigners. And the Germans have the office jobs and those kind of things, or if they study, they have those other jobs if they're capable.
What did you do in Germany between the time your father said you have to stay here until the war is over and 1923?
Well, I had this 1 year's job with the Bambergers with that baby. Then it took. Then I had an uncle that was head of a factory, and that factory, he was the buyer, he was the head of it, and that factory was all turned over to make ammunition. And they needed, and under Hitler, no, it wasn't Hitler, under the German regime, you had to do something, work, some kind of work that was taught what the war effort, not exactly making ammunition, but taking, like I learned printing, because the men were all gone. You see, the men were all displaced, and women did it. So I went to school and was taught enough so I could do it without losing my hands. I did get them in anyhow, and they're scarred for life. But that's what I did then. What I made, it was printing leaflets. But they had also, they made their own magazines, you know, three-color pictures, those machines, some of them women tended to. All kinds of printing. That I did for a while until I hurt that hand, and I was out of work for quite a while because it was too sore. Then he gave me an easier job. They had a section that was making bump and bombs for the big bombs, and on the end where they attach something to it, it's very, very difficult if that doesn't fit just so, it blows the men, the soldiers that shoot it, it explodes. And so I was one of the women that had to sit there with that instrument and test that before it was sent out. And it was a very responsible job in that you were thrown away right away if they found one that you didn't get. It was just that dangerous. And I did that then until I got married. married. I helped my father then for a while. His business had grown with the skins. I helped there with that leather stuff for a while. And meanwhile, I ran around like mad trying to get back to America. But I don't want to get too far ahead of my story because there are so much intervening happenings that I skip them if I go right on with it. I had to do an awful lot to get into America. I had no citizenship. I had no sponsor willing at first, and the sponsor, when I did get one, wasn't related to me. That makes a difference. But because I wanted it so badly, and I never for a minute accepted a no to myself that I wasn't being able to come back in here. I just didn't believe it. I was going with my boy to America. See, I knew America well enough, and I loved it here, and there was absolutely nothing out there but starvation and militarism and broken down regime and all that. So I didn't see no future. My husband wasn't able to ever make a livelihood, and while he was still alive, they paid me so very little that I couldn't live down. It was too much to starve on and too little to live on. And I didn't want my son raised in that same atmosphere again and caught up in it. So it so happened that, how did I get into that? It's like a miracle. You see, I would have never had the money. But being married, I was allowed, or I was, I could get an apartment. I was eligible. If you weren't a citizen, or if you were away from another district, you couldn't get an apartment. And I got an apartment in an old, old building that was already, they fixed it so that can be torn down. It's a relic of the past. And it's called the Kaisersheim of Hope, because Kaiser Maximilian was kept in there, hidden for 5 years. It's politically well known. And they turned that into apartments. And I got one of the apartments, what they were. I had three cells that the nuns lived in. And the kitchen of it still had the ring where they used to beat people to death. You know, the Catholic Church, this Catholic building we had all over town, you could go underneath and underneath the surface. A very historical building, and the funny part of it is later on in years when I was in America here, a professor used to come. I lived there, my baby was born there, and naturally I would be down there in that huge yard. Here was the garden where the Catholic priest used to make his sermons, a rose garden. And now it was for our use, whoever was living in that house. And I was one of them, so I would be down there in the yard with my baby, and here would come this teacher with about 16, 18 students from the university teaching him this history of, Kaiser Maximilian. There were two of them, and one got killed in Mexico later on. And that history, he was teaching those boys, and I was so interested, and I took it all in, the lectures, while I was wheeling my baby up and down. And I was here in America by myself a while, before the boy came home. And one day I read in New York in the paper where they're holding a lecture, and this in this hall, on this and this subject. And I recall that was the subject that I always listened to with that. He was a professor. And so I went that evening. It was free. It was on Lexington Avenue in New York. Oh, when I got there, it was my professor. The same that had it. Yeah, it was that unruly hair that would stand up. And I created them. I didn't know enough. In Germany, if you know people, you shake hands, whether you're a man or a woman. But if you don't, you just bow a little and, And he looked at me. He knew he saw me someplace, but he didn't know where. So finally, being in a farm city and all, I said, "Hey, Professor, Don't you remember me? I used to listen to you when you had your students there. We call those fellows docent. They have I think you have that word in English too, when they teach a certain subject. They have that by title of being not just a teacher, but a docent, D-O-Z, D-O-Z, docent.
Yes, D-O-C-E-N-T in English.
In English, yeah, you know what it means. Well, he remembered, oh yes, he said, oh yes, you saw me in kindergarten. Oh, you're the little baby carriage, and I said that. And he handed me a basket right away. You can help collect it. It's free, but he was here to make some money. And so I did, and a few more people. But of course, the people were all interested people, but had something, wanted to hear something about that stretch of history. And I never would have believed that over in New York I would meet him again. Things like that happen to you. Oh, my. Takes me all the way back to all of... I was here in America, and I was so terrible, terrible unhappy because I had to leave my baby out there. And so every minute of my free time, I had to do something, or else I'd worry so and get so depressed. So I read, and I was highly interested in all these new politics, this war outcome, and the treaty, you know, that they made after that war, and all. I knew that all by heart and had studied it. And so I went to these lectures, and I read this German newspaper. The German newspaper in New York has two editions daily, an evening paper, the big newspaper, the Staatszeitung. And I read that, and there was a rubric where you could write your opinions. And I did that for 9 years. That's where I can think I saw out there a box full of those articles, and then another new German newspaper came and asked me to do the woman's page. Von der Frau für die Frau. And you see, I could write then by then on cosmetics and on hairstyles, and I could rather tell me what to go, and I had to go and find it in the libraries. And so, for instance, one time I had to write how the diamond came to be known as a jewelry. And if you try to know the subject, I went and studied it in the library. Well, anyway, that's where I developed that habit of writing. I'm always writing something, and because it took my spare time up, and it kept my mind occupied. You see, I came here in 23, and my boy only came in 25. 2 years and a few months, and I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't even know what to do on my days off. So this was a very good hobby for me. That's how I got into writing it. And I studied more on the subjects, like the Treaty of Versailles and on things like that. When I wrote about it, I had to know it pretty good to write about it, yes. And I'm pretty, alongside of that, I'm pretty opinionated, too, you know. You look for things. Are we almost?
Yeah, I'm dragging my feet because I think the tape's almost